Hi, it's Dennis from the office calling in for a sound check.
Thanks, Dennis. This is microphone one testing.
Sounds good.
Mic two check.
Sounds good.
Mic three check.
Sounds good.
Testifier microphone one check.
Sounds good.
Testifier microphone two check.
Sounds good.
Testifier microphone three check.
Sounds good.
Microphone four check.
Sounds good.
Mic five check.
Sounds good.
Mic six check.
Sounds good.
And chair mic check.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
Have a good meeting.
call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's April 9th. We're in Juneau, Alaska, the state capital, Senate Finance. Present today, Chairman Olson, Chairman Stedman should be on his way. He had some errands to take care of. Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and myself, Senator Hoffman. Today we have four items on the agenda. First being Senate Bill 113, Taxable Income, Digital Business. Senate Bill 39, Loans Under $25,000, Payday Loans. Senate Bill 64, Elections. And Senate Bill 92, Corporate Income Tax, Oil and Gas Entities. That brings us to the first item on the agenda, which is Senate Bill 113. This bill was previously heard on March the 10th, and public testimony was taken. The only amendment submitted was from the bill sponsor, and they do not want to offer that amendment at this time. So I invite the prime sponsor, Senator Wilikowski, to the table to introduce himself for the record and give us a brief reintroduction on what the bill does.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Wilikowski, State Senator for East Anchorage, and I'm joined by David Dunsmore and my staff. Senate Bill 113 changes Alaska's corporate tax apportionment system to tax outside corporations similarly to in-state corporations. I want to emphasize this does not raise taxes on any Alaskan corporations at all. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. Do we have questions of the prime sponsor? Seeing none.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Kaufman.
Thanks through the chair to the bill sponsor. It's once again, if it's not raising taxes on Alaska companies, it is raising taxes on the products that people procure in Alaska. And how do we know that these taxes won't just become additive to the cost that these sellers are sending to Alaska, that they just don't factor in a tax algorithm and end up slipping in a kind of a backdoor sales tax on people?
We've been joined by Senator Stedman. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Senator Kaufman. This is an apportionment system that at least 36 other states have, and the historical experience in those other states is that there is not an increase in taxes on the consumers. It would be we're dealing generally with internet companies here, experientially, they do not target different states to tax them. That's the historical experience.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Follow up on that. As a consumer in Alaska, I often feel targeted. Things that somebody could easily just throw in the mail and send, for some reason, they don't ship to Alaska. And I can't understand it. So I run into a bias where... you know, something looks great, I click on it, and then, oh, we don't ship to Alaska. And I'm just afraid that we're going to add to that. So I have concerns in this environment with all the taxation schemes that are coming forth. We don't have any kind of valid spending cap that's been put in place. And so I hesitate to support any sort of tax, especially one that may wrap around and come at us from behind. So.
Senator Wilikowski.
Senator, if you can figure out a way to close the $677.1 million deficit without taxing outside corporations, good luck.
Senator Kaufman.
Well, I know that embracing every spending plan that's coming through the legislature is not the way to do that. So there has to be moderation on both sides. And I think a good fiscal plan that included all the elements that have been identified and been put forth, they're all part of the puzzle, but not any one piece.
Senator Kaufman, are there additional questions of the prime sponsor? Seeing none, Senator Keel.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I never did solve a puzzle without handling one piece at a time. So I move Senate Bill 113 here. Thank you. Senate Bill 113, which I think is Work Order 34 LS. Should that be 0564? I'll just make sure I have the right work order number on that. Yeah, 0564, which I think is slash A as in Anchorage. We reported out of committee with the attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing none, that bill will pass from committee. We'll take a brief at ease while finance members sign the report. Call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. That brings us to the second item on our agenda today. That is Senate Bill 39, loans under $25,000, payday loans. We've heard this bill previously on March 20th, took up public testimony. The sponsor has put forth amendments that have been rolled into the CS that we will be discussing. He will be presenting to the committee momentarily. So I invite Senator Dunbar and his staff to the table to introduce himself and put himself on the record and describe the changes that are in the CS and what the bill does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Forrest Dunbar, Senator from District J.
Hi. For the record, Rachel Levy, staff to Senator Dunbar.
Just as a brief recap, Senate Bill 39 involves regulations for payday lending businesses, imposing a 36% cap and removing the current exemption that exists for them in our typical laws. With passage of SB 39, Alaska would join 19 other states, including South Dakota, New Mexico, Montana, West Virginia, and Nebraska, that established these 36% APR cap. There's also a federal law that prevents these these businesses from targeting these loans towards service members or their families. And we do have two small changes, and I believe, Mr. Chair, your staff will introduce the CS.
Thank you. Do we have any questions of the prime sponsor? Seeing none, we will invite Liz Harpo, the Finance Committee aide to Senator Olson, to the table to explain the CS.
Thank you. For the record, Liz Harpold, staff to Senator Olson and the Senate Finance Committee. So as the bill sponsor mentioned, they submitted a couple of changes to the bill that have been rolled into a CS that will be in front of the committee here momentarily. What they do is it clarifies that pawnbroker business activities unrelated to payday loans are exempt from this legislation, and that mutual savings banks aren't affected by the legislation as they are already governed by pre-existing statute.
Thank you. With that, Senator Stedman, do we have a motion to adopt the CS?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we adopt CS
Is there objection? Seeing none, the CS is adopted. Do you have any discussion on the CS, Senator Dunbar? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we can have some help from the bill sponsor. I want to make sure, and this is just a policy bill, so it doesn't look like it's, you know, time sensitive, but I want to make sure that we take, that we understand the impacts of the loans that were up to $25,000, not so much a small payday loans where they were substantially discussed at the last meeting that they had a set fee. But we didn't spend much time on the bigger loans where the interest rates were higher. And I think those were probably some of the loans that were referenced as far as people borrowing another loan to pay off the last loan and then the interest rates accumulate or the interest charges accumulate. And I just want to make sure that or understand better the impacts on the marketplace that we don't inadvertently remove that those participants, lending participants in the market and foreclose the ability of the consumer that needs the $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 loans because the commercial banks aren't in that market, is my understanding. That's where these people are. And I want to make sure that they still have an avenue to secure those small loans that commercial banks do not facilitate due to the risk level.
We have three people that are online to answer questions. We have Rob Schmidt, director from the Division of Banking and Securities. We have Tracy Reno, the chief financial officer, online. And in person, we have Don Hanashu, who's the division operations manager. Senator Dunbar, do you want to respond to that, or you want to have one of the individuals that are online to address that issue?
I can respond, Mr. Chair. Senator Stedman through the chair. It is unfortunate we don't have the gentleman from the responsible lending organization online today, but he could speak a little bit more clearly. But my understanding is that in other states that have done this, that the more traditional lending institutions have filled that gap. And the folks that are doing the rollover, a lot of them are the very small dollar amounts, or quite small dollar amounts. And that I believe in the packet there is a letter of support from a traditional lender in Alaska. And they have indicated, as in other states, that they do want to service a portion of this market. And it kind of goes to your point about the $10,000 to $25,000 range. So just from personal experience, I once took a relatively short-term car loan out, you know, that was for a used car that was kind of in that range, and I paid it back, and I took it from a traditional lender. I think there are profits for traditional lenders in that space. And again, the experience in other states is that we haven't seen a huge explosion in sort of the unserviced market. I'd also want to call attention or reiterate the study that Senator Keel pointed out from Texas last year. I'm sorry, at the last hearing. Very interesting study where it compared folks that were right on the edge of qualifying or not qualifying for this loan. Off the top of my head, Senator Keel, I believe it was in Texas, but I could be it was in Texas. And what they found was, and so again, these are very similar populations, like 49% and 51%, right on the edge of qualifying or not qualifying. And the folks that qualified for the loan were much more likely to default and declare bankruptcy than people that didn't qualify for the loan, if that makes sense. That is to say, you'd think the people that qualified for the loan would be more financially healthy, but because these particular type, this product that we are trying to reduce and put the 36% cap on, because this product is so damaging to people's finances, they became more likely to bankrupt if they were able to take out the loan than if they didn't. So that's what we are trying to target with this piece of legislation.
Senator Stedman. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Are there further questions regarding the CS? Any questions from the prime sponsor? Senator Keel, do we have a motion to move the CS from?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 39, Finance, which is 34LS0357/I, as in Iliamna, from committee with, I think, forthcoming fiscal note and individual recommendations.
With that, is there an objection? Seeing none, that bill passes from committee. We will take a brief at ease while finance members sign the report. Call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. The third item on our agenda today is Senate Bill 64, Elections. This is the first hearing on this piece of legislation. We invite Senator Wilkowski, the prime sponsor, to the table to introduce himself and on the record and proceed with his presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, Bill Wilkowski, State Senator for East Anchorage, and I'm joined by David Dunsmore. Senate Bill 64 is a comprehensive package of reforms aimed at removing barriers to voting, cleaning up our voter rolls, reporting election results faster, and making other needed changes to Alaska's election laws. The bill includes provisions from 12 different bills previously introduced by members of all four caucuses and the governor. The Senate State Affairs Committee held 8 hearings on this bill as they worked to refine it. The bill removes barriers to voting by creating a ballot curing process that allows voters to correct mistakes that would cause their ballots to be rejected, and repealing the witness signature requirement that disproportionately impacts rural Alaskan voters and military voters. The witness signatures are never verified by anyone, and yet this requirement in the special election in 2022 disenfranchised roughly 10% of the voters throughout rural Alaska. And in 2024, Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, District 18, had more mail ballots rejected than any other district in the state. This is not a partisan issue. This is cutting across all lines and impacting voters all across the state. In 2022, it was estimated that Alaska's voter registration list equaled 106% of the adult population. This bill includes provisions to clarify the definition of residency for voting and to improve Alaska's voter roll cleanup statutes. It implements a ballot tracking system and includes numerous provisions to improve the security and integrity of our elections. It includes a provision requiring synthetic media, also known as deepfakes, to include a disclaimer on all electioneering communications. It includes several provisions that will allow election results to be reported faster and provide more transparency during the counting process. It requires preliminary ranked choice voting tabulations to be released whenever updated results are released. It allows elections to be certified 5 days earlier by creating a uniform deadline for ballots to be received 10 days after the election. There are a lot of other provisions, Mr. Chairman, but this is a comprehensive package that I think will absolutely improve our election system. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Welikowski. Do we have questions from members of the committee? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things I didn't hear you mention, and that's the automatic registration for when you're dealing with the PFD, and I was wondering if you could help the committee with how this bill deals with that particular issue.
Senator Welikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stedman, this bill does not impact the automatic voter registration. It has not changed that. We've had a lot of discussions on that. That was a provision that was added by the voters via initiative process. I think it was the highest percentage of voters ever in Alaska voted for that provision, and this does not change that in a substantive way. I'm going to let my staff chime in to give more specifics.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, David Dunsmore, staff to Senator Welikowski. To answer Senator Stedman's question, the only provision in the bill related to PFD registration is language is added clarifying that registering to vote through the PFD is not considered to be contacting the division for purposes of the voter roll cleanup statutes.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, I just have some concerns with that provision, even though it was fairly popular, has created more difficulty than it's worth in cleaning up the rolls, and I think we need to look at that and discuss that as we go forward with this legislation.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Further questions from finance members? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, can you give us the brief on what this changes in terms of I think the phrase cleaning up voter rolls was used. How does this shift things?
Senator Welikowski.
I would ask my staff to get into the more specifics, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Dunsmore.
Mr. Chairman, to address Senator Keel's question, there are several provisions in the bill. Clarifications of the definition of residency that our Senate Majority Counsel, Ms. Kawasaki, worked up, and she can speak to them in more detail. There are provisions that expedite, under the current process, voters who haven't voted within or contacted the division within two general elections. Every January, there are notices sent to them asking if they wish to maintain their voter registration. Currently, two notices are required. This bill will change that to a single notice. We've also added several provisions that would indicate that someone has established residency in another state, that if the division learns that, they would receive one of those notices. And then there were additional provisions added in the State Affairs Committee to require the division to hire a consultant to conduct regular reviews of the voter rolls and submit reports to the legislature identifying any areas that need further improvement.
Thank you, Mr. Dunsmore. Senator Keel, do you want to hear from Ms. Kawasaki?
Mr. Chairman, that would be great if Ms. Kawasaki could talk about the changes in the definition of residency or how that's touched in the bill. Thank you.
Kawasaki, please come forward, identify yourself. And do you need further clarification on the question?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the Senate Finance Committee. Sonia Kawasaki, legal counsel to the Senate Majority. As far as the residency requirement, in current law, there's a requirement that once you establish residency, you don't lose your ability to vote in Alaska as long as you have an intent to return. The change in the bill would require that a person who has an absence from the state would have a reasonable and articulable plan to return to the state, and that would, we think, would provide a higher bar to residency, because we think, or voting residents for voting purposes, because it is not a subjective intent. And beyond that, there are voter cleanup provisions that would address persons who appear to basically have become residents of, no longer residents of the state of Alaska, that would have the Division of Elections send those persons a notice that they need to assure Alaska, basically, that they are still deemed considered residents. And if not, then they will be moved into the voter, the list of voters that are no longer active, and beyond that, they can be pulled from the voter rolls.
Senator Keel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Kawasaki, I believe. So I just want to be sure about the residents. So residents in Alaska, just want to be sure it doesn't somehow require somebody to come back to, you know, the same exact address, that it couldn't be misconstrued that way. For instance, a college kid, if they're not going to come back to mom's basement when they come back, that the language is open enough to allow basically residency in any domicile that they may choose.
Ms. Kawasaki.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman. Currently in law, you must establish residence in the House district in which you register at. And under the bill, if you leave your House district and if you leave the state, if that would be a hypothetical, then if you have an articulable and reasonable plan to return to the residence that you registered at, then you would still meet the qualifications for voting at that residence or that in that House district. My understanding is in current law that your vote will still count by Division of Elections if you leave your the House district in which you registered at your votes and move within the Senate district. Your votes would count in that Senate district and on up broader, including statewide elections. The bill that we tried to balance with the requirement to have an articulable and reasonable plan to return to that the residence that you registered to vote at, but the intent of the bill is to allow a person to still vote if they move within the same House district in that House district.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. I'll follow up. So you're saying that it would have to be the intent to return to the same House district?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, you, in order to vote for elections in that House district.
Senator Kaufman?
Maybe we can follow up later.
Thank you, maybe Senator Kaufman. Further questions? Senator Cronk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just looking at removing the witness signature. What issues do we have with that to want to remove that?
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator, as I mentioned, in the 2022 special election, roughly 10% of all voters in rural Alaska had their votes thrown out because they failed to provide a witness signature. In committee hearings, there is in law a requirement that someone filling out an absentee ballot have a witness signature. We know there are some people who just can't get one, particularly in isolated areas. Some people forget one. And what we've seen is it disproportionately impacts people in military districts and people in rural Alaska. Understand the rationale for getting the witness signature, but it's not verified. And so I've asked the division, a little tongue-in-cheek, if hypothetically someone signed a witness signature of Mickey Mouse, would they throw the ballot out? Obviously, it's a fake witness signature, and the answer was no, they wouldn't. So it's never verified, it's never checked, and yet if someone forgets to do it or can't get a witness to do it, their ballot is thrown out and they're disenfranchised. So it is trying to fix that situation where it's disenfranchising huge percentages of people, particularly in rural Alaska and military.
Senator Cronk,
follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm kind of torn on this because I've never had a constituent call that they couldn't get two witness signatures for their permanent fund application, no matter which area I represent. So I get, and that's the reason I asked the question. I've never had that issue.
Mr. Chairman, to address Senator Cronk's question, to elaborate a little more, the witness signature requirement for absentee voting in Alaska law is a unique provision. For one, for other purposes, a Division of Elections allows self-certification where there's the absence of a notary. So, for example, if you've seen the back of a ballot initiative petition booklet, the circulator can just self-certify if there's no notary available, and that's generally how Alaska law works. The witness signature also, one of the ways in which it doesn't provide any real election integrity function is that unlike with a notarization where the notary is required to verify the identity of the person before notarizing it, there is no requirement in Alaska law that the person signing the envelope verifies your identity at all. They're only required to provide a signature. Alaska law does require that that witness be over 18, but as an evidence of how there's no verification, there's no, there isn't even a room on the ballot envelope to collect the date of birth of the person who would be witnessing, which would be necessary to verify that. And it also would just be, since, you know, this could be a service member overseas or, you know, a Peace Corps volunteer, you know, there practically would be no way for the division to attempt to enforce verifying that the witness does, in fact, meet the statute. So it, in practice, it's proven to be just a hurdle that gets voters up largely in rural Alaska as well as military voters to have their votes thrown out. And there's, you know, with the... The 2,700 ballots that were rejected in the 2022 special primary, there's been no indication that there was any irregularities with them other than just the lack of a witness signature.
Thank you, Mr. Dunsmore. Senator Cronk, thank you.
Through the chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate the answers.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, to bill sponsor. Continue on the subject of signatures. So a paper registration that's, I guess, scanned, sent by email. How are the signatures handled in those instances?
Senator Wilkowski, Mr. Dunsmore.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kaufman, could you clarify your talk? Are you talking about a voter registration form, or are you talking about an absentee?
Yeah, on registration forms.
I believe that Director Beecher from the Division of Elections is available that might be able to answer in more detail, but currently I believe the division does accept voter registration forms submitted electronically.
We do have Carol Beecher, the Director of the Division of Elections, online. Can you comment upon Senator Kaufman's question, please? Oh, she's here in person.
Good morning. For the record, this I'm Carol Beecher, Director of the Alaska Division of Elections. So for, through the chair, Senator Kaufman, for registration forms, the way that the division looks at the signature is to verify it against the Department of Motor Vehicles records. And if we don't have a signature through that, then we look at the other identifiers to verify the veracity of the form.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Is there, so that would be a scanned signature on the document. Is there any provision for an electronic signature, any kind of utility for that?
Through the chair, at this time, Senator Kaufman, there is not, although there is in this bill for electronic signatures. But yes, it's an image that we get of the DMV signature.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Are there further questions before we go to invited testimony? Senator Stedman.
Thank you. I'd like to, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to get some information from the department here on, because my understanding, again, on automatic registration, it created a lot of problems for Division of Elections and handling voter registration. I'd like to know what they think about the subject matter.
Speaker.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, in regards to the permanent fund dividend, are you referring to, could you clarify on the problems that you're referring to?
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The automatic voter registration with the permanent fund dividend registration.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, so I can explain the process, but as the process that we do is that when someone registers for a permanent fund dividend, they note on their form whether or not they are a U.S. citizen, and those are the applications that the division receives on a large batch list at the end of the permanent fund dividend registration period. We do not receive any of those forms from anyone who has noted that they are not a U.S. citizen. So what we do with that list is anyone who is a new registrant for the PFD or who has changed their address, they are then sent a notice that says, you are newly registered. Do you want to opt in to register to vote, or would you like to opt out? And the same thing for someone with an address change. If we don't hear back from them on that notice, then they are automatically registered.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think if the citizen has enough gumption to apply for a PFD, they should have enough gumption to go down and register to vote and take an interest in democracy versus the automatic registration. So just a concern I have that this policy at best is questionable.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. One of the things I have experienced as during political campaigns is a surprising amount of people that I talk to, because you're using lists that they're generated using the registered voter list, and then companies that work very hard to tie phone numbers and all that stuff to that. You talk to people. I've had a surprising amount of conversations with people that say, I haven't lived in Alaska in years, yet somehow they're still popping up on the rolls as active voters that are worthy of contact. And I mean, some of the anecdotal stories are incredible. You know, I mean, they've been gone for quite a while. Can you comment on what conditions could be driving that to occur, and whether or not the bill, I don't know if you can comment on that, if this really addresses that problem? Because just in my experience in the small elections that I've been involved in, for a state-level race, it seems like a significant problem.
Ms. Beecher.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, the voter rolls will always appear to be bloated if you were looking at them from the perspective of how many eligible voters there are in Alaska compared to how many eligible voters there are. And this is because of the intent to return language in our statutes. So individuals can reside overseas, they can be in the military, and they can be residing in another state but have the intent to return to Alaska and still be eligible to vote in Alaska. So for the purposes of the being eligible to vote, that is part of what you may be experiencing with individuals who are not, the people who live there now are saying that they haven't, the other person hasn't lived there, or someone who lives out of state and is still seen as registered. The second part is the amount of time that it takes to be completely removed from the voter roll. And that is by federal law, the 4 years for general elect, or sorry, two general elections. Then they are moved into inactive. Any kind of an act of appearing to vote will make them go back onto the active list. So the for the purposes of Alaska residents, if you currently, if you apply for a permanent fund dividend, that is an act considered to be an act of voting or of an act of doing something with the Division of Elections, and so then you would continue to be considered to be an active voter even if all you do is apply for a permanent fund dividend. So that is another component that keeps people on the voter list who may never actively vote.
That may include individuals attending college out of state as well. Senator Kaufman.
I just want to say thank you for that. It sounds like there's a financial incentive to stay on the voter rolls.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just got one quick follow-up. So you mentioned that in Alaska there's more registered voters than there are voters because people are gone and they have an intent to move back. If we looked at all 50 states, do they all have this mechanism? And if so, if you totaled up all 50 states, how much overage would we have with registered voters to how many people live in America that are age-wise ready to vote?
Ms. Beecher.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I'm not aware of those kinds of numbers. I do know that I have spoken to one of the secretaries of state from another state, and they had the same challenges where they had individuals who would come in the summertime and they resided in their state and then would go back to their other state but had registered to vote in that state and were able to continue as long as they had an intent to return. So I do know it's a problem, at least in some other states, but I can't speak to all of them.
Senator Stedman. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, while we have you, Ms. Beecher, wondering about drop boxes. What's the intent around drop boxes? How many would we have with this legislation?
Ms. Beecher.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, I can't speak to the intent, but I can tell you that according to this bill, every region, and we have five regions, would be required to have a drop box.
Senator Kaufman.
I'm sorry, I was briefly distracted. Would you repeat? I was just handed a note. It happens.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman. So the bill requires five because we have five regions and it requires one at each regional location.
Okay. So just purely at those specific locations, not satellites or anything feeding into.
Through the chair, correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was intrigued at the director's comment about how if you're inactive, you don't vote, and the division sends you notices. Right now, just registering or just applying for your PFD constitutes contacting the division and getting back on the active list. Maybe to the sponsor, is that what Section 9 is meant to fix? Is that something you address in this bill?
Senator Wilikowski or Mr. Dunsmore?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, to answer Senator Keel's question, yes, that is the issue that provision is meant to address.
Fixing problems.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Any further questions of the prime sponsor before we go to invited testimony? Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, just one more. My stream of consciousness got broken. I apologize for that. But on these drop boxes, what's the cost of them to maintain? Do we anticipate, like a mail slot, or do we have a cost for the drop box system?
Ms. Beecher.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, yes, it's in the fiscal note. We anticipate the cost of the five boxes to be approximately $23,000. And then there's shipping costs, and we would also need to have moving and storage costs because we don't have facilities like that where we could currently store them. So there would be those added costs. It's on the fiscal note, but I believe it's about probably a $30,000 total. Okay. Some
Senator
of those
Kaufman.
Will be ongoing and some are the initial purchase.
Okay, thank you. I'll take a look.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. further questions? We will go to invited testimony. In Baltimore, Maryland, we have Thomas Stewart, who's the Director of Policy, Security, Democracy. Mr. Tom Stewart, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Chairman Hoffman, esteemed members of the Senate Finance Committee. My name is Tom Stewart. I'm the Director of Policy for Secure Democracy USA, and I thank you for the opportunity to provide this testimony in support of the State Senate Affairs Committee's substitute for Senate Bill 64. My organization, Secure Democracy USA, believes that strengthening election security and improving voter freedom are not mutually exclusive goals. Rather, they are both necessary to build public trust in our elections. And since 2022, we have worked with members of the Alaska legislature on both sides of the aisle to review and propose improvements to election administration and voting integrity for Alaska citizens, which is why I'm calling in today to commend to you what Senator Wilkowski, your colleagues on the State Affairs Committee, leaders of the Division of Elections in the Governor's Office have collaborated on as represented in much of SB 64. The common sense measures in this committee substitute will bolster election security, it will protect voter freedom, and will ultimately improve Alaska's trust and confidence in future elections. It contains a number of important provisions, and I'll try to avoid repeating Senator Wilkowski and others have already laid out. But for us, some things we really want to highlight are improving list maintenance practices that will help keep voter rolls accurate, which is really important for maintaining not only administration, but just trust and confidence in the accuracy and outcome of the elections. It will improve and modernize voter registration absentee voting practices. One thing that we've been supportive of and that the division has taken the initiative on already and that this bill will support and strengthen is ballot tracking, as well as speeding up the reporting of results after election night. And it creates a uniform statewide cure process, which, yes, increases access and protects voters from having made some very minor mistake. But it is also, additionally, an important procedural layer of voter verification that, again, can increase confidence and security in the integrity of votes cast and remove any question when an absentee ballot comes in about the validity of that ballot and the identity of the person who cast it. There are additional election integrity and security measures included in the legislation before you, like creating a cybersecurity program and the definition, updating the definition of unlawful election interference. And then finally, I just highlight again the elimination of the witness requirement. This is something that is unfair in its application and has disenfranchised communities disproportionately, especially rural and senior voters. And there are simply better ways to verify and protect the integrity of voters' identity and ultimately the election. So thank you very much for this opportunity to submit testimony. Respectfully urge you to support and consider SB 64, and I would be happy to provide the committee with any additional information or respond to questions.
Thank you for that invited testimony, Mr. Stewart. We will go to public testimony. I'll open the public hearing at this time. First individual to testify is Kendra Colster from the Alaska Federation of Natives. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, good morning. This is Kendra Colster with the Alaska Federation of Natives. I'm the Director of Government Relations. The Alaska Federation of Natives is the largest statewide Native organization, including membership of 174 federally recognized tribes, 154 village corporations, 9 regional corporations, and 10 regional nonprofits and tribal consortiums. AFN has been a long supporter for ensuring our elections are accessible to everyone in Alaska while continuing to ensure ballot security. We have seen ballot rejection rates, which has been talked about, across rural Alaska that has been very concerning for us, with having provisions like witness signature where they are not verified and discarding Alaskan votes. Additionally, Alaska does not have any ballot curing process in order to fix those votes when we know that this is a process that can be implemented, and while 30 other states do have this, so we have some folks that we can look to for putting in a fair process to ensure that Alaskans can make sure that their ballots are counted. Senate Bill 64 includes some important voting reforms that we are supportive of, including rural liaisons, prepaid postage, ballot curing, use of electronic signatures, removing witness signatures, ballot drop boxes, language assistance, and permanent absentee ballots. These are important to ensure that all Alaskans have easier access to be able to vote, and just making sure that their voices are heard through the process. We do want to add caution for any provisions that would limit access for voting and disenfranchised voters, such as repealing the automatic voter registration. This is something that was supported widely by Alaskans. We don't see any issues with being able to make sure it's easier for people to vote that are getting be able to do it through their permanent fund application. Additionally, there has been talk in other committees about not allowing votes to be counted that are received after Election Day. I just also want to caution that we do not put any provisions in such as that, because we have a lot of folks from rural Alaska and the military where their ballots might take a little bit longer to get through the mail process here, and just have to understand that we have some difficulties in mail here. AFN lends our support to Senate Bill 64, and these are very good common sense election reforms, and we hope to see that the bill pass this year. Gunachish, Kwana, thank you. I really appreciate the time to offer public testimony.
Thank you. We have a question from Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if AFN sees a high correlation between Western Alaska villages and then the small towns and villages in Southeast dealing with ballots that weren't counted because of messed up signatures or no signature at all or what have you. I was wondering if you've done a regional comparison so we can get an idea of the magnitude around the state of that issue.
Ms. Colster.
Senator Stedman, through the chair. I do have a breakdown, which I can send over to the committee. It's not right in front of me, but I know in 2024's general election, we had about an 8% rejected rate for missing signatures. And districts 38, 39, and 40 in particular had a higher rate of about 14%, from my understanding. But I don't have the breakdown of Southeast, so I will get that and can send that over to the committee, but I have talked with folks from Southeast, as I actually am from Southeast, and I know that there are, when talking with my family even there and some of our tribal administrators, that there have been some issues around the witness signature. I just don't have the very specific percentages right now, but I will get that to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Stedman. We'll stay in Anchorage and hear from Randy Rudrick. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. It's my privilege to appear today for the Senate Finance Committee to address some issues that I've worked on for many years on state elections. First, I want to correct your record on something that was spoken to earlier. In 2001, I looked at something and was shocked. We had more people registered in the state of Alaska than were of the voting age. This is not a new problem. It's been with us for some period of time. It was at least present in 2001, and it was probably present before. I didn't bother to go back and check. The automated voter registration did not create this problem. The permanent fund registration did not create this problem. He's been with us for a long time. Now, let's talk about residency. We may have a problem with residency, but the solution that this bill provides is not a solution. This is an execution of the right to vote in Alaska. This returning to the residency that you just left, I would characterize that as a snowbird law or a university dropout law. If you're not gone for very long, you're likely to return to your same residence. If you're gone for a slightly longer period of time, it would be nonsensical to expect our voters to return to the same residence that they had lived in 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. Their family needs have changed. Their world has changed. Their economic situation may have changed. For example, they may have graduated from college. They may have left the military, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this particular solution to residency is not a solution. This will force many people who should stay on the voter roll off the voter roll. Secondly, let's talk about the witness signature. Our culture has worked with the signing of a document and a witnessing of that signature for thousands of years. We have now decided that we don't want a witness signature because people during COVID had a hard time finding anybody to sign their ballot envelope. I do know, in looking at the number of witness signature challenges that we had in districts in the West, that, for example, in the 2024 election, District 38 had one unsigned ballot turned in and one witness signature. Not 10%, not 12%, one out of the entire population. District 39 had no unsigned ballots and two witness issues. We are seeing a complete mischaracterization about the witness problem. The witness problem existed when we had a mail-in election in rural Alaska, and when we had COVID issues that required people to avoid everyone else. I believe that the ballots we received in the 2024 election were nothing short of remarkable. They were great quality and prove that witness signatures and ballot quality are very high. What does that say? Well, first of all, we probably don't need a cure process since 90% of our ballots essentially avoid the cure process completely because they're cast on election day or cast as early votes or cast as absentee in-person votes in various villages and in other processes. So we do not need a cure process because there's virtually nothing to cure. The only thing the cure process does is give us a tool when someone wants to implement mail-in voting, which will create a huge level of issues as it did in 22. Furthermore, if we don't have a witness signature on our absentee ballot, it loses its authentication. And the same folks who would like to make some changes will immediately say, well, we need to get a signature verification on the ballot signature. So we're not solving a problem, we're just creating a difference. On the deadline change, I commend folks for going from 15 days to 10. But I would encourage us to get over it. Let's make the change, have all the ballots in by election eve. Many states do that. There's no reason we can't. I've looked at it. It will require a minimal effort to encourage people to not be 2 or 3 days late. There's virtually no ballots in the state, after day three or four, well, let's not have a remaining 10-day tail. Let's cut that tail down to less, and I would prefer it to be zero.
Thank you for your testimony. We will stay in Anchorage and hear from Mike Garvey. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, I am Mike Garvey, policy director for the ACLU of Alaska. We support Senate Bill 64 because overall it will help uphold the voting rights of Alaskans and improve the integrity and administration of our elections. Such measures include the creation of a rural community liaison to help with the unique challenges of administering elections off the road system, providing paid postage for absentee ballots, and language to ensure that special needs ballots are not rejected because of errors not made by the voter. We especially support sections to repeal the witness signature requirement and to establish a ballot hearing system. These steps are needed to ensure that absentee votes from qualified voters are not rejected for administrative and inadvertent mistakes. The witness signature is consistently a leading reason why absentee ballots are rejected, but for reasons discussed earlier, it does not improve the security of our elections. In fact, in litigation over this requirement during the 2020 election, the state could not identify one instance in which it helped detect voter fraud. The ballot hearing provision would allow Alaskans to ensure their votes are counted when their absentee ballot envelopes are missing a signature or if the voter wrote down an insufficient identifier. Packing these reforms together would address prominent reasons why ballots are rejected each year. According to data from the Division of Elections, during the 2024 general election, 242 ballots were rejected in districts represented by members of this committee because of the witness signature or curable reasons. Statewide, more than 60% of rejected absentee ballots could have been counted if these measures were in place. It is critical that the legislature enact ballot hearing first with the Division of Elections enough time to implement a system ahead of the 2020 election. Second, the division adopted regulations last year to formally end the practice of accepting some ballots with minor errors on the envelope. Because of this policy change, it's reasonable to expect that ballot rejection rates will go up if the legislature doesn't act. Finally, the Alaska Superior Court recently ruled that the responsibility to implement a ballot hearing system falls to the legislature. During litigation, the Division of Elections agreed that it had capacity to implement this system and agreed that providing notice and care might actually increase voter confidence. In a state where voting is the cornerstone of our democracy, counting every eligible vote is essential. We urge the committee to advance SB 64 because it would help achieve this goal, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for that testimony. We will go to the last testifier from Portland, Oregon, Barbara Warner, the Executive Director of the National Vote at Home Institute.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. Thanks so much for this opportunity to provide testimony in support of Senate Bill 64. My name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I am the Executive Director of the National Vote at Home Institute. We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that works to increase voters' confidence in, access to, and use of voting at home with mailed-out ballots. We want to applaud the work of the State Affairs Committee that in the work they did to present this comprehensive proposal to you in the Finance Committee that will, among other electoral reforms and improvements, will expand access to mail ballots and the systems that support voters' confidence in them. A couple of the best practices that I know you've heard of, but that I'll just highlight. We work broadly in states across the country on this, and a couple of the best practices that this bill will bring in. First of all, as has been mentioned, eliminating the witness requirement, which increases voter convenience and participation. Implementing the ballot tracking and a standardized curing system, along with the 10-day post-election deadline for ballot receipt. That is has a significant impact on voter confidence and knowledge in the system, and it also provides ample time for election administrators. Providing the sufficient drop boxes and prepaid postage for returning ballots in a variety of ways, and then allowing the pre-processing of ballots before Election Day, because that's also going to help you with faster reporting. One other thing that we would add, I understand that it's not part of this bill now, but we are advocates for and would advocate in the going forward as a best practice to allow voters the option of what we call a single sign-up, also known as permanent absentee, to vote at home. This really maximizes voter convenience and decreases administrative costs for election administrators. The idea of allowing voters to automatically sign up to receive all of their mail ballots going forward, because really high numbers, over half of folks who sign up for ballots for one election sign up repeatedly. So you have significant cost savings when you are allowed folks to do a single sign up for future ballots rather than having to reapply for each election. And then finally, just as a reminder, the use of mail ballots has really been embraced by voters over the past few decades, but certainly since 2020. It's popular, it's secure, it's cost-effective. It saves local governments millions in administrative costs every election while ensuring that voters, especially those in rural and indigenous communities, have increased reliability and access to the ballot. And in Alaska, of course, you have a long history of innovating on this front. In 2016, the Anchorage Assembly approved a resolution to establish vote by mail as their preferred way to vote. The resolution stated that it was a strategy to increase voter turnout, thus empowering Anchorage residents with a stronger voice in the democratic process and in the decisions that directly impact their daily lives. That resolution helps cement Alaska as a leader in voting reform that increases voter enfranchisement. Now, Juneau has joined Anchorage, and both benefit from the cost and administrative savings of running all vote-at-home local elections and the increase in turnout. So given Alaska's unique geography and population, expanding vote-at-home is a critical step towards ensuring that all eligible voters can participate in the democratic process. We at the National Vote-at-Home Institute have worked since 2018 with policymakers, election officials, and election administrators to support the implementation of a broad range of effective vote-at-home systems. We applaud your ongoing work with the Alaska Legislature and ask that the committee vote to advance Senate Bill 64 to continue making voting as accessible and secure as possible for all Alaskans. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that testimony. That exhausts the people that want signed up to testify. We will close public testimony at this time. Senator Keel, can you review the fiscal note?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we have two fiscal notes for Senate Bill 64. The first is from the Alaska Public Offices Commission within the Department of Administration. It's OMB component number 70. They submit a zero fiscal note. The Division of Elections in the Office of the Governor has also submitted a fiscal note. That's OMB component number 21. They do not show an FY26 cost. They show an FY27 cost of $338,800. All unrestricted general fund, that's one full-time position and five temporary positions. Mr. Chairman, as we look into the out years, we see that the Division of Elections levelizes their even-numbered, odd-numbered years to an average each year of 290,100. The one full-time position remains constant, and the five temporary positions are every other year.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Wilikowski, do you have closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Wilikowski, State Senator, East Anchorage. I have nothing to add.
Thank you. Brief Eddies. Bill. Come back to order. We will set this bill aside and take a brief eddies while we set the table for the next agenda item, which is Senate Bill 92, Corporate Income Tax, Oil and Gas Entities. We're eddies. call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. The last item on the agenda today is Senate Bill 92, Corporate Income Tax, Oil and Gas Entities. This is the first hearing on this bill. I invite Senator Kathy Geisel and her staff to the table to introduce this piece of legislation. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, the presentation, I mean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kathy Geisel. I've been entrusted by the people of Senate District E to be here today. Mr. Chairman, I am presenting Senate Bill 92. This would put in place an updated S-corporation tax structure for Alaska. Mr. Chairman, I will emphasize this is not a new tax. We've had S-corporation taxes in the past. We changed our structure of taxation in the state, and this was not updated at those times. So this bill will update the tax structure. Mr. Chairman, I completely respect the knowledge of the folks sitting at this table. However, the public is also listening, and so I will go into some detail related to the difference between C corporations and S corporations as they're designated and created by the IRS, the federal IRS. This slide briefly gives a definition of those two entities. A C corporation are entities that are taxed separately from their owners, so they pay on their profits. Then the shareholders who receive dividends from those corporations pay taxes again on the dividends they receive. It's often referred to as a double taxation, Mr. Chairman. S corporations, on the other hand, are a newer entity. They were created in 1958, Mr. Chairman. So that's before Alaska even became a state. They are typically smaller. They have no more than 100 shareholders, as you can see there in the list. The shareholder can't be an alien, things like that. You can also see that the latest information I could find from 2024 indicates there's over 11,000 S corporations of different sizes here in our state. We don't know how many of those S corporations work in the oil and gas industry. Moving on to slide 3 now for the folks at home. There are other entities that fall under this category called pass-through entities, and that's limited liability companies. These were first introduced in 1977. Alaska was a state at that time. They, again, can take different forms, but essentially they're similar to S corporations in that they themselves are taxed through the people that own the LLCs. And you see the different category. They could be a sole proprietorship, a traditional partnership, that is a limited liability partnership, or they could be an S-corp. The LLCs can elect to be taxed like an S-corp. So not as an entity or as an entity, or as a the LLC can be taxed as an S corporation where the people that own the corporation are taxed on their personal income tax versus a C corporation. Interesting number, the 2024 number from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development identifies over 67,000 active LLCs registered in Alaska. Pretty amazing, Mr. President, Mr. Chairman. I'm moving now to slide 4. So why does this matter to Alaska? It matters to Alaska because the folks that own these companies are taxed through their personal income tax. Alaska doesn't have a personal income tax. Mr. Chairman, as you know, we have implemented individual income taxes in 1949 while we were still a territory, but we repealed it in 1979. This was because we had a tremendous inflow of oil revenue, and We felt we didn't need it. We had a permanent fund. We were giving out dividends. And so we repealed our personal income tax. That repealed the taxes on S corporations and LLCs, which had been formed by that time. Mr. Chairman, I'm moving now to slide 5. This simply reiterates the fact that Alaska adopted the IRS code as its standard, and then and prior to 1980, stakeholders in S corporations paid the tax through their personal income taxes, but then we repealed that personal income tax in 1980. Moving on to slide 6. Just as a point of interest, folks at home certainly will probably ask this question. Are we the only state that doesn't have a personal income tax? No, in fact, there are 9 states. You see, we are one of them. I will call your attention to Texas and Wyoming. These will become relevant later on in this conversation, Mr. Chairman. But these are the other states that have no personal income tax, and you see the rest of the state's systems. Moving on to slide 7. Slide 7 shows you the current structure for C corporations. So again, these are the very large corporations. They're traded on the stock exchanges. They are taxed based on their profits as a corporation. The shareholders of these corporations are then again taxed if they get dividends. They are taxed on their personal income tax. These are the tax brackets. They were last amended in 2013. So you see that the C corporation earning above $222,000 will pay our highest bracket of income tax at 9.4%. I'm going to contrast that, Mr. Chairman, by moving to slide 8. This is what is being proposed in Senate Bill 92 for S corporations who are engaged in oil and gas industry. Essentially, there is a $5 million credit or deduction from any taxes that are under $5 million for these organizations. So at $5 million or more, they then would fall into the top bracket of 9.4%. So this is a significant tax credit. When you compare it with the previous slide, C corporations only get the tax credit of $222,000. In this bill, we are proposing a credit or deduction, if you will, of $5 million, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to slide 9. This proposed update in our S corporation tax structure is not new. It's actually been identified now for several years. This is the January 2021 indirect expenditure report. I know that the members of this committee see that report. Many of the rest of the legislature also recognizes this to be an important report. In it, the various taxes and sources of revenue are evaluated, numbers are presented, and in this particular edition, January 2021, recommendation was made that this S corporation loophole, as they referred to it, be terminated. Underlined, you see the statement, without a state personal income tax, these corporations receive the legal benefits of incorporation without any state tax liability. And so it was recommended even 4 years ago to repeal or to close this loophole, as I would call it, update our tax structure. Moving on to slide 10. This is a slide that was presented in 2021 also. You see it August 10th, 2021. It was presented by then Department of Revenue Commissioner Lucinda Mahoney. Mr. Chairman, you and Senator Keel on this committee were part of the 32nd Legislature's Fiscal Policy Working Group. This working group looked at ways to address our fiscal policy, and one of the recommendations that came out of it was to expand our corporate income tax to oil and gas pass-through entities. And you see here that recommendation. You see the small amount that would be estimated to add to the revenue stream. And the estimate at that time for the first full year would be of revenue would be $67 million. That was the estimate. You see the cost for doing this, no incremental cost to implement this change. So again, calling out, this is not a new idea. It's been proposed before. Moving on to slide 11. Again, respecting the knowledge at this finance table, but understanding that the public is also viewing, I just took a page from our latest revenue forecast so that folks could see what our petroleum corporate income tax revenue looks like now. And this corporate income tax is on C corporations, so our large companies. To call them out, ConocoPhillips being one, Exxon being another. So in FY 2024, year just concluded, $210 million. This year it's forecast to be $190 million. Next year, $230 million. It is a substantial revenue stream for the state, but you also see that this is being paid by C corporations engaged in oil and gas. Moving on to slide 12. So when we discussed this at the Resources Committee, we had a question. Let's take this particular bill being proposed. What would it look like actually applying it and contrasting it with a C corporation company? Now, I have to emphasize here again, Mr. Chairman, as all of you at this table know, the Department of Revenue is restricted through confidentiality requirements to not tell us how many S corporations there are in the state that would be liable under this bill for tax revenue. So we don't actually know if it's one company, if it's 10 companies. We don't know. But what the Senate Resources Committee proposed to Mr. John Letourneau, who is a CPA, what would it look like applying this bill if the company made $1 billion in profits? And you see the calculations here. Mr. Chairman, I'm giving you I'm turning to the end of the book to see how the story ends. Mr. Letourneau is invited testimony, and he will go through his calculations with you when you get to that point, Mr. Chairman. But that's the last page of the book, just giving you a preview there. Moving to my last slide, which is slide 12. Mr. Chairman, I pointed out that there were two states, as well as Alaska, that do not have a personal income tax. Those two states are Texas and Wyoming. This particular chart that you're looking at right now came from the website of a large S corporation operating in our state in the oil and gas industry. And that company, for folks at home, on slide 13, you'll see this came from the Hillcorp website. It's interesting. These are the six locations that they do work. The state and local taxes paid in those locations, the number of barrels per day, gross acres under production, producing wells, and employees full-time. I just pointed out as interesting information, Mr. Chairman, you see Alaska at the bottom under the state and local taxes paid as a non-applicable. We don't have a personal income tax. We have no mechanism with which to tax this particular example of an S-corp. It is not the only possibly, but we don't know how many there are. Now, the argument has been stated that, well, you know, if we were to update this S-corporation tax, it would be incredibly burdensome on our S-corporations because it costs so much to work here in Alaska, and I believe we all acknowledge that. We understand we are an Arctic state. It is an Arctic environment with many challenges. But, Mr. Chairman, I will also point out that the average royalty in Texas fields like the Eagle Ford and parts of the Permian, those royalties are over 20%. Mr. Chairman, in Alaska, our royalty rate is 12.5%, on some fields 16.6, well under 20%. It's been stated that it's 10 times more expensive to work here in the North Slope than it is in the Lower 48. I've talked to some experienced folks, Mr. Chairman, and they certainly admit that it is twice as expensive for rig day rates on the North Slope than in the Lower 48, and other costs are higher too, but the total costs are nowhere near 10 times as expensive as is often cited. I will point out also, Mr. Chairman, that many of these companies, this one in particular, is invested in actually all three of our oil-producing regions, heavily invested in Cook Inlet, owning virtually 90% of the assets there, an operator on the North Slope, a partner with Chugach Electric in the Beluga gas field, and I don't know if you've seen the latest news, but this particular company is partnering with Doyon to work in what we call Middle Earth. Mr. Chairman, in our tax structure, as we put that together a few years ago, we called Interior Alaska Middle Earth. We see that they're invested there as well. So I believe assets will be significant. But we don't know because the Department of Revenue cannot share that information with us. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation. I do think you'll find it interesting to talk with Mr. Letourneau, the certified public accountant, who applied this tax update to a theoretic company that might be making $1 billion in profit. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to take questions. My staff is ready to do a sectional if you'd like.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. We will forego the sectional. Do members of the committee have questions of Senator Giesel? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it would be helpful for the committee to look at it from a different perspective than what's presented here. This is one perspective. I would like to see this looked at as if we go back in time to we did Senate Bill 21 several years ago, which was a major tax reorganization bill. And when we did that, regardless if you supported the bill or didn't support the bill, that's not the issue I'm putting on the table. But when we did that, we looked at the government take, which is, for those watching at home, that's a percentage of the net revenue after you take out your cost oil that stays with the government, the federal government and the state. Obviously, to look at our revenue, we got to take out the federal government. But in looking at that, when we looked at the sharing relationship with the industry, we really had four major components. As referenced, we had our corporate income tax. We had property tax, we had the royalties, which Senator Giesel had mentioned, and we had the severance tax. We have these four components. And those four components all added up to the state's share with different weightings. Corporate income tax has a smaller weighting than most of the other entities, particularly royalties and severance, generally speaking. But when we looked at corporate income tax, we don't talk about it a lot because it's pretty static. It doesn't move around like royalty revenue and severance. It moves a little bit with profitability. But there was three major players, Exxon, BP, and Conoco in the state. And we took here at the table the corporate income tax and basically broke it into three chunks because we don't know who's paying what. But there's three major players, so we just, you know, equally divided it up and kind of went on. As BP phased out, British Petroleum, when they exited, they sold to Hill Corp, which is the S Corporation. So we lost, hypothetically, general terms, broadly speaking, because they won't tell us information, Department of Revenue, a third of that corporate income tax. That reduced our government share relationship, decreased it, and therefore put in an imbalance, all else being equal and held constant with our government take. We lost some cash flow. Well, the question then becomes, one of the questions, is the marginal benefit of losing that revenue, whatever it is, or whatever it was, and we can try to get a better handle on what it actually was, with the marginal increase in production that Hillcorp brought to the state through their, more efficient operating costs, more nimble, smaller company, lower overhead, different tax structure, all the things like that that they brought to the table. And clearly when we look at production, at least all the production I've looked at, there is undeniable increase in marginal production over the years since Hillcorp's here, been here. So they have increased that marginal production. Then the question becomes, is it to our net benefit over what we lost in the tax revenue, or is it not? And, that's one of the fundamental questions that I think we need to explore. Even though it's kind of a small component part of our government take, it's still significant. And I think a lot of times corporate income tax is a few hundred million a year, and we can go back and look at that, have that brought to the committee. But I don't know how we're going to bifurcate the marginal production. I think we need to ask DNR. I think we need to ask Hillcorp. And we need to look at what we lost and try to figure out if it's a net gain or a loss, and what do we want to do about it? Because clearly our government share position, if it was hypothetically balanced when we did SB 21 years ago, we moved cash to the other side of the table. Now, every time they talk about changing tax structure, they talk about instability. But instability is when they take cash from you. Stability is when you get the cash. So it all depends on what side of the table you're on. On this one, we were on the wrong side of the table. I think we should explore that along with how this other view that the bill sponsors presented for us to look at. I think we need to take a deeper dive into it and take a look at this.
I would agree. Do you have any comments on that, Senator Giesel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stedman, the Senate Resources Committee did ask DNR to come to the table, which they did. They compared at $68 a barrel the difference in revenue. They pointed out that it would be a 2% decrease in the producer take-home to incorporate this particular bill. It would make a difference of 40 cents in profit per barrel at $68 a barrel with this state corporate income tax put in place. They had much more extensive slides that I know this committee would find of interest. Senate Resources didn't have time to go through it, and it is revenue, so that's your purview. Thank you for those ideas, though, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Further questions? Senator Kaufman?
Really just a comment to Senator Stedman's statements. And I think, the question is the net total return and whether or not this incentivizes or disincentivizes production and the returns that we get from it. And I agree with your statements. I think that's the right perspective to look at this question by. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to figure out the best angle to view it from, and it's a little difficult to set forward-looking tax policy looking back at the last at the past. So I guess there are a bunch of ways that we could we could look at the category of folks who ought to pay any given type of tax, the principle being that you tax similarly situated folks the same, and the government ideally doesn't pick winners and losers. Should the category be oil and gas companies? Should the category be S-corps versus C-corps versus LLCs, corporate structure? Should the category be those companies that are reinvesting versus those that are, I think someone once upon a time referred to in harvest mode. He may have had a Dutch accent. How ought we look at this? Because I think about some C-corp, oil and gas corporate income taxpayers who are investing really heavily right now, and they're going to pay this tax. So I'm trying to figure out how ought we look at the category.
Senator Giesel.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Keogh, if we are attempting to reach an equal or fair tax between C-corps and S-corps, that's going to be very difficult to achieve, because remember, the C-corporation pays the tax as an entity, and you see that we only give them a $222,000 credit, so to speak, before they're in the top category. But then their shareholders also pay taxes on any dividends they receive. So that's a double tax there on a C-corp. With the S-corp, we're giving them a $5 million credit, so to speak, before they become liable for any taxes. That is the purview of this committee, to alter this bill however you wish. There was discussion about why limit it to simply oil and gas. Is $5 million the right amount of credit, so to speak, before the tax implements? Should it be lower? Should it be higher? These are all things for you to consider. I will point out that it does include entities that transport, are in the transportation industry as well. Production of oil and gas in state, or transportation of oil and gas by pipeline in the state. So I haven't covered all the facets of this bill. It also unitarianizes, creates them as a unitary business. So let's say that it is a C corporation and they have subsidiaries that are LLCs or S corps. Those subsidiaries will be unitized with that C corp. So they will not be separately taxed under this C corp, under this S corp. They will be counted as part of that C corp. So there's facets to this that are much more complex than what I've just presented to you. But certainly, if you feel there are changes that need to be made, that's certainly what we do this committee business for.
Thank you, Senator Keogh. Let me give the committee a hypothetical, and it's just a hypothetical. We see what Hillcorp has done. Hypothetically, what would this committee do if we were faced with ConocoPhillips and Exxon becoming S corporations? I think the answer is clear what we would do. So in light of that hypothetical, I support this particular piece of legislation. Any additional questions of the sponsor? Thank you, Senator Giesel. Brief at ease. call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. We have one individual with invited testimony as the sponsor of this legislation stated, John Letarno, CPA with Thomas Head and Gerson. He's online. Please identify yourself and proceed with your invited testimony.
Hello, my name is John Letarno. I'm a CPA in Anchorage, Alaska, with the firm of Thomas Head and Brighton. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My presentation is very short, and as shown on slide one, the title slide, it is simply designed to illustrate the hypothetical situation where two similarly situated companies have the same amount of taxable income, and what is the difference in the Alaska statutes between a company being taxed as a C corp and a company being taxed as an S corp. So the hypothetical assumes $1 billion of pre-tax income as defined under the Internal Revenue Code for the company. And that's the first slide. And next slide, please.
We're on the next slide.
The second slide merely shows, The second slide here merely shows that at $1 billion of taxable income, federal taxable income before state income taxes, a C corp would pay the state of Alaska $93 million, and an S corp earning the same amount of taxable income would pay the state of Alaska zero. This is the discussion and the way this Alaska law is currently stated. Slide three merely shows that the taxes paid at the corporate level, the entity level. So at the entity level, the C corporation pays and an S corporation or a flow through entity, an LLC, does not pay. And so slide four. Slide four illustrates the impact of the tax bill as proposed, Senate Bill 92. The same hypothetical $1 billion pre-state income tax, taxable income. The C corp would pay $93 million, and S corp would pay slightly less, $93.5 million. The difference being the impact of the $5 million exemption. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Yes, we have questions from committee members. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair, to Mr. Letourneau. I'm curious about a term that's been used in this committee to characterize the current situation. Loophole. Is the present tax policy a loophole? Could you define that, please?
Mr. Letourneau.
Through the chair, a loophole to a tax person is a benefit that someone else gets and I don't get. So I might say that a loophole is if I am exempt from individual income tax in the state of Alaska because I am an Alaska resident, but if I move to Oregon and was subject to Oregon state income taxes because I was an Oregon resident, that the Alaska statute created a loophole, which I might try to exploit by picking my state of residence. I don't know if that answered your question.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. It addressed it, but I think it still raises the question of why is this a loophole when it's really just tax policy and it's the structure that was in place, and it still leaves behind all the other questions of if we want production, what behaviors are we doing that enhance production and the total return, and I don't know if calling this a loophole is really on the right track, but thank you.
Thank you. Further questions of Mr. Letarno? If not, we'll try to get in two individuals under public testimony. We'll open the meeting for public testimony and invite Doug Woodby to the table, followed by Karen Moriarty, and then we'll close the public hearing for a later date. Mr. Woodby.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Doug Woodby, and I'm speaking for myself. I support SB 92 for two reasons. The first is that it honors the Alaska Constitution that tells the legislature to make sure that the public gets the maximum benefit from use of our resources. And number two, I think Alaska needs the revenue badly. I'm a grandfather with grandchildren in the Juneau public school system, and our school system is hurting, as I hear is true all over the state. So that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We would invite Karen Moriarty to the table to identify herself and proceed with her testimony.
Good morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman, Co-Chair Stedman, Co-Chair Olson, Vice Chair Merrick, other members of the Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, commonly referred to as AOGA. I thank you for the opportunity for public testimony today on this bill. As many of you are aware, AOGA is a professional trade association representing the majority of oil and gas production, exploration, refining, and transporting activities in the state, and our mission is to advocate for the long-term viability of the industry. AOGA firmly opposes targeted taxes, and as exemplified by the bill before you, Senate Bill 92 does impose a new discriminatory and retroactive income tax on a select group of firms in the oil and gas industry. As the bill sponsor stated, in 1980, the Alaska legislature eliminated income taxes on individuals and pass-through entities such as privately owned S corporations, regardless of the industry at the individual level. Senate Bill 92 seeks to reinstate an income tax, but only on one industry and only on a limited number of firms in that industry, those businesses with qualified incomes exceeding $5 million. Out of the approximately 50, or as I saw Senator Giesel say, over 60,000 limited liability corporations in Alaska, of which over 11,000 are S corporations, this legislation appears to be aimed at a subset of taxpayers in the oil and gas sector and is attempting to tax just one company in particular. In addition to being a targeted tax, the bill does seem to overlook the strides being made on the North Slope by that company to increase production. So we have three, we've identified three unintended consequences of the bill. One, its retroactive application does undermine investor confidence in Alaska's fiscal stability. Two, without proper modeling and analysis, the full impact on affected businesses and how many businesses remains unclear. And three, the construction of the bill creates confusion and ambiguity. Suffice it to say, AOGA's members have several technical concerns with the bill, and while I don't have time during public testimony to go into detail outlining those concerns, we would welcome the opportunity to provide detailed written comments about those technical concerns, and if appropriate, come back and share these concerns at a future hearing. So in closing, the oil and gas industry has been a bright spot in Alaska's economy. And the last thing we argue Alaska needs to remain competitive is an increase in taxes. So we urge the committee to set Senate Bill 92 aside and instead allow the industry to continue to help Alaska grow. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman, and I'm happy to answer any questions if time allows.
Thank you. We do have an individual that is the executive director for the Resource Development Council, Leela Kimbrell. Please identify yourself in Anchorage and proceed with 2 minutes of testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Co-Chairs Hoffman, Olson, Stedman, Vice Chair Merrick, and members of the Finance Committee. My name is Leela Kimbrell, Executive Director for the Resource Development Council for Alaska. I testify today in opposition of SB 92. RDC is a nonprofit trade association representing Alaska's fishing, tourism, timber, mining, and oil and gas industries. And for 50 years, we have advocated for a strong, diversified private sector and to expand the state's economy through the responsible development of our natural resources. We have long held that responsible fiscal policy should be balanced against a meaningful spending limit, policies that encourage expansion of a diverse private sector, reducing the budget deficit in a way that encourages long-term investment in our private sector, and must include stable tax policies critical to maintaining and enhancing our competitiveness for all industries, including the oil and gas sector. SB 92 does not do this. Rather, this bill unfairly targets only those S corporations in the oil and gas sector with income exceeding $5 million and would be retroactively applied. Moreover, this appears to be targeted at one specific company, although it impacts several more in just one industry. Yet we know that there are over 11,000 S corporations registered in Alaska in other industries throughout the state. The targeted, discriminatory, and retroactive nature of this bill appears to raise legal and constitutional concerns as well that should be addressed. As members of the legislature, you have an obligation to consider how this will impact future resource development and Alaska's long-term competitiveness. SB 92 threatens investment and opportunity in Alaska, including both the North Slope and in Cook Inlet, a resource critical to lowering energy costs in Alaska. In sum, less investment means less development, less production, leads to lower throughput in the taps, fewer well-paying industry-supporting jobs, and ultimately less revenue for the state. For these reasons, we encourage you to oppose SB 92. Thank you.
Thank you for that. There are well over a dozen members that individuals that want to testify on this bill. We're going to be closing the public hearing and reopening the public hearing at a later time when we bring this bill back before the committee. So I'll close the public hearing. At this time, we will set the bill aside, and the next meeting, I believe, is tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. So we are adjourned.